Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
And now I'd like to introduce our moderator for tonight's discussion, Bridget Mullins, a playwright whose plays including Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, Topographical Eden, and Pathological Venus have been produced in New York, London, and San Francisco. Bridget has received a Whiting Foundation Award and an NEA Fellowship, among others. She has taught at Harvard University and at Brown, and for 15 years she curated the reading series at Dia Art Foundation in New York. She is currently the director of the Master of Professional Writing Program at USC. Tonight's program will conclude with an audience Q&A. We ask that you wait for the microphone to come your way as we record for podcasts. We also want to be able to hear the question that you're asking. You're all invited to join us after the program in the lobby for a book signing. Books are on sale courtesy of the library store, with proceeds going to support the LA Public Library. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Bridget Mullins to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin. Our writers are now filling the stage. I want to thank Justin and Louise and the library for putting together not only this evening, but for all of the evenings of this ongoing series. They make it look easy, but literary programming is not easy. Allowed brings in writers from all aesthetics and genres and creates a climate of linguistic delight and ongoing conversation here in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles as a place is the common thread and focus of tonight's reading, which brings together three writers who are Los Angeles-based. As someone who teaches graduate writing students right up the road at USC, I'm very grateful for this series, so thanks for keeping it going. The structure of tonight's panel discussion is that I'll say a few words about the writers, they'll each read short excerpts, and then I'll ask some questions. After about half an hour, they will each read for 5 more minutes, again, short excerpts, and then we'll open up the floor to questions that you might have. So as you feel questions brewing, please make a mental or manual note of them. You'll have a chance to ask them. Kenneth Burke writes that, quote, terrain determines tactics. And by so saying, he sets the stage for our inquiry tonight as we hear from these writers about what it is to be a writer in Los Angeles, such an intensely decentered and visual town. All three of these writers have taken on the mythology of the place. I'm thinking of Janet Sarbanes' desert settings, Veronica Gonzalez's descriptions of Mount Washington, and Vanessa Place's topography. They all three explore the quiditas of place, as Aquinas puts it. They're all active meditators in a mise-en-scène, a place and time, a milieu. To know who you are, you have to have some place to come from, Carson McCullers writes. The other terrain that we'll look at tonight is the landscape of the human body, that sensory vehicle. These are three women writers. How does and what does that location, what does that do to the syntax and to the language and to the stance? Thirdly, there is the terrain of venue. Each of these writers have published with independent presses. What's the relationship between their publishing experience and their process? To begin with, though, let me give you some brief bio and contextual notes on each of them, and then they'll read, and then we'll carry on. We need to get their voices in the room. Veronica Gonzalez was born in Mexico City and raised in Athens, Ohio, and Los Angeles. After receiving a degree in art history, she studied writing at NYU, and while in New York, she co-edited Inflatable Magazine, a zine which enabled her to work with many of her art school heroes, including Dan Graham, Lawrence Weiner, Chris Krauss, and Lynn Tillman. Always interested in bringing artists and writers together, she co-edited Juncture, 25 very good stories and 12 excellent drawings, a cross-genre anthology published by Soft Skull Press. In 2005, she began Rocky Point Press, which produces books of truly collaborative artist-writer pairings in association with 1301 PE Gallery in Los Angeles. I want to say a few words about her novel, Twin Time, How Death Befell Me, which was published by Semiotext. This is a quest narrative set in three, or at least three, time zones, and structurally reminiscent to my mind of Godard's Injunction, which is off of Aristotle. So Aristotle says in the Poetics that every story has to have a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And Godard comes back with, yes, every story has a beginning, a middle, and an ending, but not necessarily in that order. So of course Aristotle's talking about the notion of causality, and that's something that Veronica Gonzalez is playing with that idea in Twin Time. It's a confabulation, part mythology, part fairy tale, of a young woman's quest to find her identity. As I just mentioned in her biographical note, Veronica Gonzalez's background includes a study in interaction with visual art. And indeed, I first met her maybe 10 years ago in the gallery spaces in Chelsea, or maybe it was Soho. But without having seen her in that context or knowing her background, you'd get a hit of her art school training from the deep level of sensory acumen in her descriptions. As Wallace Stevens has said, quote, accuracy of description is the equivalent of thinking. And her descriptions are sublime. This is the ecstatic description of a baker. Quote, did I mention that my father was a very big man? No. Well, my father was really quite fat. It fits in perfectly, you see. He was a baker, a candy maker. For as long as I can remember, he worked at home, rising at 4 every morning, using the fruit in season for pies, whipping up perfect cloud-like meringues to be eaten individually as cookies are, making jellies out of guavas or tamarind, taking eggs right out of the chicken's bottom, and transforming them into perfect flavor-laced flans, creating a whole alternate world out of chocolate and marzipan. His specialty was a cheese and grapefruit cake, the bitter tartness of the fruit stopping the sweetness from spreading too far into your mouth with every bite. In that passage, you get a hint of her agility and also of the way she directly addresses the reader. Indeed, this is something that all three of tonight's writers do, breaking the fourth wall, moving around the story. Twin Time, or How Death Befell Me, is full of spontaneity and mystery. There's also a profound sense of humor and irony at work. The novel is a quest by a young woman to find her mother and then her twin brother. And after a mythopoetical middle passage where she is in a forest, she encounters feral children, giants, penitents, and carnivores. After all these dream figures and portents, in the end, it's an internet detective who helps her find her long-lost brother. The book contains transcendently gorgeous descriptions as well as the deep compassion of a writer who, it seems to me, believes that writing is a redemptive act. But more on that question later. Please join me in welcoming Veronica Gonzalez.
Thank you, Bridget, and thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. I'm not going to be reading from Twin Time tonight. I'm going to be reading from a novel in progress. And all you really need to know, well, you don't really need to know anything because it's the very beginning. So I'm not going to tell you anything. This chapter is called Julia 2005. Okay. It's not to say that things were always terrible. They weren't. Most of the time they weren't, and I was happy. Lots of people around me, aunts and cousins and friends, my grandmother. We would eat together often, all of us. Big meals which one of my aunts would prepare with the help of the housekeeper, my aunt being the only one who didn't go out to work at that time. My grandmother, the sole adult in that house, really, her children all still in their 20s, worked her job at the National Palace, so was gone most of the day every day, and on weekends loved to play cards, poker for small change, her glasses on, deep concentration, a cigarette in her mouth, two fingers tapping, everything flowing in and out of her, and she herself focused on her hand. So that every week there was a parade of folks streaming through the house, old people mostly, but often with children or grandchildren in tow, so that they weren't always uninteresting to us, those card games. My grandmother laughing and joking and sipping wine or coffee and picking at olives or nuts or dried fruit which somebody had brought. We would play too, sometimes. Piles of change in front of us, scheming, trying our hardest to cheat, never really knowing if they were letting us win or not. No, things were not always terrible. I remember laughing, like other children laugh, until I couldn't breathe sometimes, chasing my sisters or cousins around the couches in the living room, shrieking with your it delight. And later, as teenagers, there were parties where we moved those couches into corners, and I danced with boys I had a crush on and were now miraculously in my house. Who had invited them? Their green eyes. Who knew these boys I liked? But I'm getting ahead of myself. In those days, still a child, I remember running wild in the street with friends, getting glimpses of boys or girls who were godlike to me, older and beautiful, the gorgeous Sebastian, whom none of us yet knew was gay and whom I can't think of now without seeing Mantegna and his saint, arrows piercing holy flesh. And then the slow-walking girls, their perfect clothes and hair. Or of that other boy, whom I'd only seen once or twice because he didn't inhabit the streets like us, his family strict, my same age or just a little bit older, beautiful with dark eyes and milky skin. His lips were red, and my eyes had locked with his once, him up at his window like a princess caught in a tower, and me down below, the dashing and wild one, the prince with the promise of freedom in the very air which floated around me, and I delighted in my male vigor then, my chivalrous offer of pure love, my saving from towers in exchange for a kiss from those beautiful lips. I parted my own lips then, and his mother, as if alerted, called from within that big house, and he dropped eyes, and I rode off on my dragon, and then I was merely a girl again, inexplicably controlled by the shadowy intrigues of the adults around me, my mother, unaware of her secrets, the dark, sad places, sometimes terrible, from which she roamed. But on these warm summer nights, it was as if there were no adults for miles, and I could be anything, a dashing young prince, on these long, warm summer nights, running wild in the streets, Mexico City summer streets. I was happy, too, when he would show up out of the blue, our handsome father, with a pile of cash in his hand, a game played in his favor, a night of gambling turned right, and off we would go into the country, the rest of Mexico, my younger sister and me innocent and trusting after months of not seeing him, and now we were disappearing like our mother, like she did so often into dark, unsettling nights, her absences extending into weeks sometimes. But now it was us, leaving with almost no notice, shoving things into a bag while yelling out at our aunt that we were going with our father, and then riding off in his VW out of the sprawl of the city and into a forest where at a restaurant in which we stopped once for a late dinner, they kept a pet deer, a fawn, huge black frightened eyes staring out at us, her neck tied by a long length of rope to a tree just outside. I reached out to touch, but she was so shy, backed away in such terror, that I drew my hand back. Or to the beach one time, a tour of those beautiful Mexican beaches, endless swimming, floating atop rising, rolling, falling waves, letting ourselves go for a while, Marta and me out further and further until a fear would strike inside us that we may become irretrievably lost, and we would lap our way back toward the shore, yelling out while our father disappeared with newly made friends. We didn't need him, for it was us in water forever, nearly naked at 9 and 10, at the edge of knowing what being naked meant, what it might imply to some of them, the old and judging Catholic ones. He always traveled with boys, teenagers mostly, and on this particular trip, my father had Pablo with him, a boy 4 years older than me, 14 at the time. He would become a poet and a mathematician, was already brilliant and thoughtful and decent, and what was he doing with our dad? I remember Marta and me sitting over him on his bed in the room we'd gotten for the night. Where was our father? We sat near him as he lay propped up by a pillow, and we teased him about loving our sister, Rocio, who was the one everybody always loved because she was the sweet and strikingly beautiful one. He didn't answer our teasing, but talked on and on to keep us there. And in a stolen moment, Marta having gotten up for some water, he stared into my eyes, and so I touched his nipple for 1 second while I continued to tease about Rocio, though he said he didn't like her. His tone had dropped, was low and serious, and I saw that there was hair beginning to grow around where I had touched. And though I was just a child, deep inside me, I felt what it is I felt.
Janet Sarbanes is the author of the short story collection Army of One and is currently completing a novel. She teaches narrative writing and theory in the CalArts MFA writing program and cultural studies in the School of Critical Studies. She has recently published in Popular Music and Society, Utopian Studies, Black Clock, After All, and the anthologies Still Moving Between Cinema and Photography and the Nulipian Analects. I have been a fan of her essays on communes and collectives, and I've been intrigued by her fascination with desert landscapes. In her amazing short story collection, Army of One, Janet has created a sort of Spoon River anthology for the Angeleno. This is from her magnificently funny and touching story entitled Alien Encounter. It contains this description of the sexual encounter between an alien and a woman who lives in the desert. Quote, "They lay down on the airbed in the living room and took off all their clothes. The alien was an ectomorph with a narrow concave chest. She was an ectomorph too, so at least they had that in common. She tried to see if the alien's sexual organs resembled the ones in her dreams, but as soon as she laid a hand on him, his entire body gave off a bright green light that obscured her vision. Lying there, wondering what to do, how to pleasure an alien, she suddenly realized that this was how he was going to make love to her, with light. He waved his shell hands over her." And then she goes on to describe, in exquisite detail, sex with an alien. It is a delicious, funny, adventurous, and irreverent story. And the other stories are as wildly imaginative. They include a wild child, uptight PTA mothers, and reluctant muses. And always, always, it seems to me, Janet is reaching to articulate and to define the gap between self and other, something perhaps to ask Janet about later. Please join me in welcoming Janet Sarbanes.
Thanks, Bridget. I really enjoyed hearing you read that. I thought, in keeping with tonight's theme and sort of the California-LA connection, I would read an excerpt from a story that's the first story in Army of One, the collection. It's called Dear Aunt Sophie. And it takes the form of an email interview with Aunt Sophie that's conducted by her niece. Subject, first question. Dear Aunt Sophie, I know you haven't said yes, but I'm going to send the first question anyway and see what happens. What made you want to be a writer? Subject, Ray, first question. What do you mean by writer? Subject, writer. I guess I mean someone who writes. Subject, Ray, writer. Dear Alexa, I've been thinking about your question. What made me want to be a writer is that I got bored and disgusted with people. That might seem counterintuitive, since writers write about people, or in any event, things having to do with people. It's the prison house of language. When words are your medium, your art relies upon people for its very existence. You can't just pour paint down a mountain and call that your art. You can't make a house out of bottles and call that your art. I don't know, maybe all art is for other people somewhere down the line, but word art is for other people pretty much from the beginning. Unless it's word art that takes language apart and makes it a thing or a substance, but that's not what I do. Regards, Aunt Sophie. Subject, follow-up question. Dear Aunt Sophie, thank you so much for answering my question. I wasn't sure what you were saying about the prison house and that stuff, but my follow-up question, I guess, is why did you get bored with people? Subject, Ray, follow-up question. Why did I get bored? I don't know, but it seemed to happen very quickly. I think by the time I was 11, I was pretty much through. How old are you? Maybe you're not old enough to have had this experience yet, but that's the age when I first started to hear them repeat themselves. It was like they were on a loop and it was all coming around again. And nobody seemed to think through what they said. They just seemed to be afraid of not having something to say, that if they stopped talking for 1 minute, they would all fall into some great big hole. By then, I'd also found out about war and murder and slavery and prison and private property and famine and the way girls are supposed to act and the way boys are supposed to act and breast implants and the Virgin Mary and seabirds getting strangled by plastic soda can rings and the Diary of Anne Frank and where women aren't allowed to go in a Greek Orthodox church. And I thought, can't you people come up with anything better than that? Subject, make people different. Dear Aunt Sophie, I'm 10. So did you start writing because you wanted to make people different? Subject, Ray, make people different. I did want to make different people, Alexa, people who were more interesting than real people, or no, who were made out of the most interesting parts of real people, called characters. Date, 11-16-03, 6:57-02 Pacific Daylight Time. Dear Aunt Sophie, are you coming back to Baltimore for Thanksgiving? It would be great to interview you in person. My teacher says that's really the best thing, plus I'm starting to forget what you look like. Date, 11-16-03, 11-14-03 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. No. Subject, next question. Dear Aunt Sophie, did you move to California to become a writer? Subject, Ray, next question. I'll give you one piece of advice, Alexa, and that is this. If for any reason you ever feel you're doing anything less than realizing your full potential, leave. Leave that day, get in your car and go. Don't hang around for years on end thinking things will get better because they won't. They'll stay the same and you'll get worse. California is a good place to go because it signals a definitive break. If you stop at Minnesota or even Montana, people still think you're going to return someday. But California says you've gone as far as you possibly can without falling into the ocean. If you're that motivated to get away, you're not coming back. Our dad, your papu, had an expression when we were growing up. All the fruits and nuts roll to California. He put a negative spin on it, but you see what I'm getting at. There are lots of people in California, Alexa, but there are big open spaces too, and freeways. A freeway is like an expressway on the East Coast, only faster and more solitary. The freeways are full of people driving alone. In a better world, they'd all be carpooling, but for the moment, they're just trying to get away from each other. Of course, you do relate to other people on the freeway. You yield and you merge, and occasionally you call the police on your cell phone to report a car with a stolen child inside. But you do all that at high speed, so you don't form attachments. Sometimes when you're driving late at night, the freeway narrows down to a single lane, and you see a giant yellow arrow blinking in the distance. You think when you get to it, you're going to see something really big, but there's nothing, just the blinking arrow, and then all the lanes open up again. I like to take the freeway to the desert or the ocean, and we have both of those in California, where you can see for miles. That's the only time I feel like stopping the car and getting out. Subject, Baltimore. Dear Aunt Sophie, how come you wanted to get away from Baltimore so bad? Subject, Ray, Baltimore. Baltimore's not so bad, Alexa. Sad, maybe, with all those empty row houses, but not bad, and there are sad places wherever you go. I just never got started on living there, that's all. Looking back, I think it must have been my death drive that propelled me home after college. It certainly wasn't Eros. That can't have been easy on anybody, especially with a restaurant to run. Kima's many papu used to bark when I was slow to take an order or the time I was clearing away dishes and poured salad dressing all over the mayor. Do you know any Greek, Alexa? Well, in case Papu ever yells it at you, Kimi's many means sleepwalker. Subject, republishing. Oh, sorry, subject, publishing. Dear Aunt Sophie, we don't see Papu and Yaya as much since the restaurant closed, but whenever we do, Papu is very quiet. Mom says he's tired. Can you tell me something about your publishing experiences? Subject, Ray Publishing. Dear Alexa, have you ever been to Paris? When I finally got to Paris after I've moved to California, I sat on a bench in the Luxembourg Gardens. Those are the ones with the wide paths lined with gravel that crunches under your feet and the octagonal pool where children race sailboats. And I thought, you stupid fool, you could have had a whole other life. Not that I wanted that life to be in Paris, mind you, or God forbid, among the French, but sitting there on that bench staring up at an unforgiving gray sky, the kind of sky you look into and see yourself, not cherubim or poodles or God, I was struck by how easy it would have been if only I'd put my mind to it. I know you don't remember what I look like, Alexa, but I remember you. In fact, the last time I saw you, I thought you showed a lot of potential. We were sitting in the living room and you were sawing away on a cello or a violin or one of the other hundreds of instruments your mother has had you playing since birth when somebody banged through the door, your little brother maybe? Anyway, you looked up with a fierce gleam in your eye as if to say, hey, I'm making music here. And I thought, this little girl is going places, provided she doesn't fall off the trail, provided she keeps her footing as she's coming around the bend. But even if you do fall off, Alexa, you can get back on. That's what we believe out here in California. I think I'll stop there.
Well, Vanessa Place is a writer whose work I've known for a few years. I first heard about her work when I was teaching at Brown, where she has a big fan base in the grad program and among the faculty. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, I heard her speak at a conference, and I heard her read at MoCA, and I heard and saw the lovely books that her Les Fig Press puts out. In addition to being a writer, Vanessa Place is a criminal defense lawyer. And in addition to her novels, her nonfiction books, her essays, she's also written for television, including teleplays for Hercules and also for Xena Warrior Princess. She is the author of Dies, A Sentence, a 50,000-word, one-sentence prose poem, and the post-conceptual epic La Medusa. Her nonfiction book, The Guilt Project, Rape and Morality, will be published by The Other Press in 2010. Place, as I mentioned, is the co-founder of Les Fig Press, described by critic Terry Castle as, quote, an elegant vessel for experimental American writing of an extraordinarily assured and ingenious sort. In short, Vanessa Place as sprizzatura, the Italian term for doing many things at once and with a sense of ease. A post-conceptual epic is what Vanessa has termed La Medusa, and Book Sluts reviewer Jacqueline Davis describes it as being, quote, an innovative take on typography littered with visual stimulants, not just a catchy Hollywood sign and white trash redemption bumper stickers, but much more, uncharted geographies, filmic directives, fade in, geometric voids, literary references. Joan Didion noted, quote, the city burning is Los Angeles's deepest image of itself, phrenological definitions, end quote. In the spirit of full disclosure, I should tell you, our audience, that I myself, in Medici-like fashion, sponsored a section of this book, and that's another aspect of the independent publishing world that we'll address later, the communal aspect, and the idea that there are, quote, no price tags on the art, or indeed that the making of writing can exist outside of the marketplace and its strictures. An epic is a long narrative poem, commonly told communally, because the cast of characters and the litany of adventures is too wieldy for the single brain. And therein, in all of her contrapuntal clevernesses, Vanessa Place will indeed take us into the brain and back again. The brain, however, is housed in the body, and the female body is one structure that Vanessa Place loves to capture with words. Her archi-ecriture is the lesbian body, and this delicious description we watch as, quote, Rocky kisses the high inside of Stella's thigh, where it tastes like popcorn, only sweeter, saltier, corn from the fall festival, kettle corn, corn you eat by the fistful as you and your honey pie stroll around the fairgrounds, watching the cotton candy kids list on the tilt-a-whirl and the pharmacist guess the weight of the farmer's wife. You stop to test your strength against Betty Boop's bell. You're a He-Man and bow over the wooden milk bottles to win a mirror-inlaid Coca-Cola, and you put Honey Pie's hand on your crotch beyond the funhouse for fun. And Rocky props herself up to get a clear look at the clock, spreading her hands far and wide to gain some purchase on the waterbed. Please join me in welcoming Vanessa Place.
Before I start, could I have a volunteer from the audience? Is there somebody who could help me for a moment? It's the take-home portion. Witness the windpipe motel sprung forlorn from tattered desert shoals, squatters' oily pits spurting full-blown from bits of sea biscuit and strung birds burst to unsung flight, from stuttered rooftops pronouncing each quake by a violent, numb emigration. Our shattering swarms fly this way and that, brittled as layers of frozen glass and temporary quarters. The lip of each ring blushed with liminal twilight. Let us begin again at the sump primeval, commission its stink with plates of salted black fig and golden roast pork, sweetened with fallen segments of freeway, including an overpass many lived under. Our salient tableau will tell and tell in iterate syncopation how we poor mountaineers hardly slept in our stucco houses and terraced apartment complexes, each confounded by a swimming pool, those suffering eye pits, those bright drops of subcutaneous sea glass, where people of all parts skinny strip and stripe their backs with cacti. For we live in a desert, we do, it's true, true as a German tattoo. Our lands bake browner than blackstrap beans like the daddy mastodon and the strawberry-scented woman. We cleave to standing water, each one of us mistaking our Brea for an oasis. Albeit such mistooks are commonest in the multiplex, what with the licorice chips and jumbo boxes of jujubes, de noche todos los gatos son padrosi. So grab a trowel and come on in for good hot soaking, and later there'll be sing-alongs and s'mores, hot dogs and hoedowns, and a moment of silence for that. There'll be bonfires and bonjours, free beer and great cheer, lire and l'enfer and lanyards to give at the neck. I was en allemand for 5 years, EC for 8, or maybe it's the other way around, always the most direct. It'll take longer, but we'll get there sooner. And though my numbers may be wrong, as numbers tend to be, but my point is Germany, brooder Germany, is a place whose past was blown up, though certainly not out of proportion. And it politely bulldozered to the rest, directing instead a series of brass slots through which one may pitch fennings or forks. And it is a crime in dear Germany to speak approvingly of history. Similarly, this place ironclads its antecedents. After naturalement marching the bewildered townsfolk through to see, to witness their terrible society, let's pull up a lawn chair to watch the shock, we'll attest a uniform disgust and cry, beautiful. At the tar paper pitch of our undreamt night, après will delight our dismay with fall-colored buckets of hot-buttered popcorn and fun-sized treats, Twix, Mounds, Snickers, and Sitch, handed round by red-vested concessionaires and maquillage, our snacks accompanied by a treacle of amnesia such as soaps, operas, and purples, the pits of our mummers. Some call them heroes, while others say sub. Those happy bucks slated to revolve the overwrought door, relearning lessons learnt the week before. Shat out as one is shat in, lips blush with innocence, or at least rouged with a plea of not guilty. Why, it's every mother's dream, because as the good doctor goes, it's rude to remember the past, and worse to recollect the future. Without art, only history, without channel, only sea, and all ages horror, and each dawn a fresh-blooded curse. Leave us, my love, leave us to cross our fingers and hearts, pledging forevermore to evermore forget the potted skulls and pillows of 100% human hair. though it would be nice to cast a net for the dandruff. The flat, tacky flakes could be seeped in warm water, the distillate laced with wenneled cream and the compound sold in amber amples. It's brew for what ails you, nothing for nothing, that is to say, for backstories better left to invention, a memorial statuary best kept at a minimum, given the homeowners' association. Though N.B., in neither location must exist pre-1945, and both believe in carbon monoxide freely applied. Thank you.
Okay, so thanks for reading. It was good to get your voices in the room. I wanted to start off with a question I sort of hinted at for Veronica, and actually for all of you, is this idea of writing as a redemptive act or a seductive act. And in the passages that we heard tonight, actually, there does seem to be some sort of interplay between the act of writing and the art of listening, or what it is to have an audience. And I just wonder if anyone wants to talk about the possibly redemptive nature of writing. With Veronica in particular, I'm thinking of the passage in Twin Time where Mona sees another person and sort of compassions herself into that person's place. And that idea of being in the other's place. And it reminds me of what George Steiner said, that reading is a deeply moral act and that it makes you less capable of passing by. And it just seemed that there's a thread of some sort of redemption throughout.
Yeah, I guess for me, the act of writing is a truly empathic, it's a truly empathic act. It's something in which you're involved in this extremely personal way. You know, you lock yourself in a room. A lot of us don't want anything, any noise, nothing intruding. And yet, for me, there's always this act of reaching out to my characters and through my characters to the reader. I guess that a way that I've come to think about making art is through through Winnicott, who's a psychologist, British psychologist, he was the head of the Psychoanalytic Institute in the 1950s, and he worked a lot with children coming back from the war, and so he kind of developed this idea of a transitional space, which is a space in which for children, it's a space that's not the mother, but isn't really fully the outside either. And I think of art that way. That's a philosophy that I've brought to my thinking about art. That it's a space, the transitional space is a space that's not fully mine. And so when I put my art out, I'm putting it out for the viewer to come to and have their own experience in. And so I'm always aware of that communication between my reader. And that's always my first communication. It's much more important to me to have a relationship with my reader than it is for me to have a relationship with my characters, actually. It's always a reaching out to the reader and a belief in the reader and that kind of space within which there's an interplay between me and the reader.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that in reading Twin Time,
yeah.
That I felt like I was helping assemble the fragments, and all the true fragments were there, but I had to pay attention.
Right. There's a lot of reaching out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Janet, I would pose the same question to you. And I was struck by Aunt Sophie's description of the prison house of language. Mm-hmm.
I actually, in this collection, I have a fair number of sort of disappointed writers or artists or who are sort of struggling, who really do believe in the redemptive power of it. It's sort of a very romantic kind of approach that they take. Aunt Sophie is actually not a published author. She's a technical writer, as it turns out, which her niece wasn't really aware of. That still is sort of the impulse in the story. And I think also I'm interested in email and how that makes us all writers, in a sense, and we're all constantly every day engaged in kind of an epistolatory kind of communication. And I also in my novel, I have there are three sections, and a whole section is an email communication. In that, there's the whole idea of writing for someone and having an audience that is a very personal one, in a sense. And I'm interested by that, and I'm interested in using forms that speak to a narratee. They're being narrated to a narratee who is ostensibly a person or is a character, and then the reader is kind of on the other side of that. So you're witnessing an exchange, and you're witnessing a communication, and you're witnessing maybe the redemptive power of writing in between two people, but in a kind of, I guess, in a frame. So it's a little self-conscious. You're outside of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And going to that idea of sort of self-consciousness then in the writing, and the idea of commenting on the writing as you're writing, and as we just saw with your reading, Vanessa, you're often commenting on the institution of readings during your reading. And how does that sort of inflect your writing practice? Are you, when you're writing, are you thinking of the sort of the ride that your audience is going on with the text? There's so much that's graphic, it's sort of on the page, but it's hypertext. You know, there's a lot of agility in the language, and a lot of punning. Mm-hmm. Like this endlessly leapfrogging mind backwards and forwards, and so
just think of a flea, like jumping sideways periodically. Yeah, I think that for me, it's far more about the book as object and language as object, and so I think that comes into play a couple of different ways. One is that the book becomes this very visual thing to me, and the page becomes a very visual thing to me. And so what can I do to play with the pain of the page itself? But then also the materiality of language, and part of the materiality of language is meaning. And so what can I do to expand that property at the same time? So wanting to engage in sort of all of the things that my material can do.
And that kind of brings me back to something that was sort of hinted at, this idea of status, and what that has to do with who gets to be an artist in this society. And maybe that links in some way to this notion of experimental writing. And you know, this evening was sort of characterized or framed by the trope of Los Angeles writers. So all of you are writing out of a place, and you're in a place. And part of our fascination, like I was thinking in Twin Time, one of the characters charts distances by freeway exits. And since moving to Los Angeles, you know, I've really understood the whole car thing in a way I never got before. And you know, we have this shared milieu. I know it's you know, there's it, but you know, to see it written and to see it reflected, and all of you have. used this or meditated upon this, you know, the thing with the car and how that's a common thread. But there are other common threads throughout, and I'm just wondering what it is. I mean, do you all think of yourselves as experimental writers or of pushing the envelope of form in some way? I think they're, you know, they're very distinct styles and aesthetics going on. And Janet, once again, I was struck by, I think it was Aunt Sophie who said, characters are the most interesting parts of people. So this sort of composite component in creating a character. But in terms of yoking that back to this idea of experimental writing, how would you say your work is experimental? Or if you would go that route,
Janet.
Vanessa, this is for you, Vanessa.
Well, experimental is sort of its own genre. I would say I'm less interested in creating, in having an experiment, and more interested in creating textual objects. With this book in particular, one of the things that I was really interested in was narrative. So how many stories could I include within one story, essentially? With the piece that's a 50,000-word sentence, it was how could I make one entity that continuously falls apart? What would that be? Right now I'm working on something that's so hideous I can't even describe it. And I'm also doing a couple of appropriation projects. So for me, it's less about experimentation, and I think more about, I read a lot of art theory, I was interested in what you were saying, Veronica. So it's more this engagement of what can I do with words to, I like words better than people. I do. They're more interesting to me, quite frankly. Though I told Janet before tonight, I do criminal appeals, and I represent sex offenders on appeal. And the other night, I caught myself working on a forcible child molest case as I was watching a documentary on Auschwitz. And I thought, well, maybe I'm going too far now. But there is something to me in this notion of not redemption, because I don't like that idea, but this notion of transcendence through symbology, through art, through language. There's something really grand and really pathetic about it, which I quite like. Janet?
I can talk about this a little bit. I guess that for me, coming from an art background, the idea of realism, I see realism as a form, which And that's such a, you know, that's been such a long discussion in the visual arts, and for some reason in fiction it's not really talked about. People act as if realism equals real, what I like to do are I like to play around a lot with narratorial voice, so I switch voice a lot. Sometimes in the middle of a paragraph, I play a lot with circular narratives. I tell stories from a lot of different points of view. I address the reader directly as a way of reaching out to the reader, not as a way of pushing the reader back, which, you know, a lot of people talk about that as a way of, like, pushing the reader away. And actually, I see it as a way to reach out to the reader and bring the reader in. And I guess that all of... I never really thought of myself as an extremely experimental writer, but when I was in graduate school, I was really attacked, and so that's when I started seeing that what I was doing, if you see writing as real and through this prism of realism, that all this stuff can really mess with people's heads and people's ideas of what a story should be, and I guess I don't really think a story should be anything, So for me, the opening up of telling, At the same time, I love story, and story is really important to me. So while I'm doing all these other things, I tell stories, and I'm playing around with both of those things and kind of walking the fine line between playing with form and telling stories is, I think, what I really love to do.
One thing, when I was reading Twin Time, once again, I thought of Flannery O'Connor's something she wrote in Mystery and Manner. She said, a story isn't successful unless it hangs in the mind, unless it resists paraphrase. And that's something that's happening. But then you have that sort of Nabokov twist at the end with the internet detective. So you're doing all of this lovely exploration. And if you haven't read this book, I want to buy it for every young woman I know, because it's such a beautiful coming-of-age story. But there's this incredible intelligence about now that's going on in it, too.
Oh, thank you.
And then for Janet, you're working with these short forms, and you're doing a lot with communities and with...
Well, I think in terms of experimental writing, there's actually a tradition of experimental writing right now, and it comes out of modernism. And I admire this. It's not what I do. I write satire, But in satire, there's a critique of conventions and forms, social forms. But inevitably, you're going to foreground and critique, in a sense, the conventions of narrative and sort of how stories are told and what makes a character and all those kinds of things. So so I would say, yeah, what we call formal experimentation is inevitable when you write satire. Mm-hmm. But this is a question we're always banding about at CalArts, and there's so many kind of ways to look at the experimental. I was actually, you know, Aunt Sophie says word art, where you treat the word language as a substance or a medium. That's not what I do. And that was a little bit what I was saying, in a sense. That's something I admire and identify, and I see as a kind of modernist continuation of purifying language and text. But my experimentalism comes out of satire, yeah.
But all of the, I would say all of your forms in it, or all of your approaches, to some extent, challenge the status quo in some way. And would you say that that has something to do with being women writers? That there's an innate challenge to the status quo, whether it's structurally about how a story is told, how time is experienced, or whether it's this Jonathan Swift-like response. But, you know, the same thing has governed theater for years, this idea of psychological realism being like the template that you have to hit all the marks, when television and film really did free theater from the strictures of psychological realism long ago. But there's always this model that people just take, and they're looking for it to hit these marks, where it doesn't have to hit those marks.
Right, and what's nice about what Veronica said is, I think once you start looking at realism as a genre, not a genre, as a medium.
Style.
Or a form or a style, then you can start leaning into the artifice of realism and playing that as well. So you can play with juxtaposing bits of realism next to something that's very abstract, and that kind of heightens what's going on, that neither one is particularly real.
It makes both more right. Interesting, too. You know, it doesn't take away, it adds to both. As forms, God, how great, you know, that you're actually an artist making something, you're not just denoting what's going on.
Right. So the no reportage.
Well, I also think, just on the woman question, I definitely, you know, and I think this is true in all of our work, that, you know, gender is of interest and it is at issue. And definitely, if you're approaching things formally, then it will lead to new forms, maybe, or different forms. But I also, in terms of challenging the status quo, in terms of fiction, for instance, like, in my opinion, women invented the novel. Like, the great novelists are women, and sort of readers of novels are women, too. So the kind of... I mean, that may have been appropriated away towards a kind of male genius kind of model, but if you look at Jane Austen and Edith Wharton, et cetera, that's, and the Brontes and all of that, you know, they're, so they've helped to define the conventions of the genre that are realist, and I guess I'm just saying that's sort of how the gender question plays out for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Henry James, who might as well have been a woman, right?
Yeah. And George Eliot,
who was a woman in a lot of ways, right?
He said, when someone asked him how he would structure his stories, he said, "My stories are based on investigations. When a character is known, the story is over." That way of approaching the story.
His decentered sentences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we should, before we turn things over to the audience, talk a little bit about the Los Angeles question. And none of you are native Angelinas. I believe Vanessa Place grew up in various military bases around the country. Janet's from Baltimore. And Veronica was born in Mexico City and raised in Ohio. So how did living in Los Angeles and sort of describing Los Angeles, how has living here inflected your work, do you say?
For me, I don't think I could have lived in any one place as long as I've lived here, because I could move around. It's a city that doesn't really imprint itself upon you. If I'd lived in New York for the same amount of time, I would probably have become a New Yorker at some point. But I was able to live in L.A. and keep moving around L.A. and never become part of it. So hooray. And but what I think that enabled me to do is that in some ways this book is almost the one of my secret fondnesses is for Middlemarch, George Eliot's book. And Middlemarch in many ways just takes this one small English, middle English town and really explicates it. And Los Angeles is almost the exact opposite of Middlemarch. But you can write, I think the poly nature of Los Angeles was something that was inherently familiar to me. And the sort of sense of permanent expatriate status was also very familiar to me. So Los Angeles made sense to me. And it made sense in terms of what I wanted to do with writing, too. It's a place that also just makes stories all the time. That's what it does for a living. And so you can play with all of these registers and all of these makings and these fabrications and all of these voices, and that is what the city is on the day-to-day. And everybody's Los Angeles is in their own head. You know, how I live my Los Angeles is very different than how I'm sure, you know, somebody else lives their Los Angeles.
And what neighborhood do you live in?
I live in West Adams.
Well, I tend to agree with Vanessa that one of the great things about Los Angeles is that you can carry so many other places inside you and be fully here as well. A lot of my writing is not set in Los Angeles, and I think that Los Angeles is a place like New York that attracts people from all over, and it's a constantly changing city. I was gone for about 10 years. I went to NYU and then stayed in New York, and when I came back, Los Angeles was a completely different city. And I'd been back to visit, but hadn't lived here in a while. And it had gone from being a city of the suburbs to becoming a city of neighborhoods in those 10 years, which was remarkable because it was one of the things I admired about New York, the neighborhood nature of it. And lo and behold, now it's Los Angeles. And it's, you know, it'll continue to change and become other things. And yeah, I like the kind of modal nature of it. I also like that it's so open and free that you can do anything with your art here. It's New York felt very oppressive to me as a writer.
What part of LA do you live in?
In Mount Washington.
Yeah. Janet?
I think that I have I definitely have an outsider's perspective on LA. Even though I've lived here, you know, for 16 or 17 years, in that the idea of LA, or really California, what it represents, what it represented to me back in Baltimore, and, you know, all the fruits and nuts roll to California, and it's sort of if you start to identify with the fruits and nuts, that's where you decide you want to be, you know. And so I think there is that whole tradition of writers who write about Los Angeles. Many, many of them are coming from somewhere else. And so it represents all the kind of aspects of freedom and light and space. And I'm particularly interested in how many people here are living out their dreams. There's the actual physical landscape, which is sort of dreamlike because it's so the light is so amazing here, and it's like a sort of that's why the, you know, film kind of gravitated here. And then there's the, as Vanessa said, the landscape where the LA, it's not the landscape, it's the idea of LA, the idea of themselves and what they're doing here, that everyone's carrying around in their heads, and you're always interacting with their particular dreams, and it can be a little spooky. But it's always interesting, I think.
And what neighborhood do you live in?
I live in Glassell Park.
One thing I noticed when I was living on the East Coast and teaching there, all of my students wanted to come to Los Angeles. 10 years earlier, they all wanted to go to New York.
So, and these weren't just the visual artists or the poets. This was everybody, even the theater artists. Wow. So I think there has been a sea change. I don't think we'll have time to read another passage. I think we should turn it over to the audience and see if there are some questions. I think, Justin, do you have a mic? Justin has a mic. So, back there. Oh, two questions, okay.
So, Veronica, you were talking about reaching out to the reader, and I wondered if you have an ideal reader.
No. It's you.
And I also wondered, just to keep you talking, what you're reading.
Who reaches out to you, that is? Well, I've just taught a class on the novella, and so I've just been reading these great novellas. And a friend of mine who's here, George Bakari, turned me on to this really great Czech writer, Joseph Skvoreky. I don't know how to say the SK and the V. I don't know how you pronounce that. But he has this amazing book called The Bass Saxophone, and this novella called Imoke in it, which the sentences, if you were here when I read, my sentences are very long and kind of convoluted, and those are his sentences. It's just beautiful writing. And then I've been reading Roberto Bolaño, and you know, I could talk about people I love, Lydia Davis, I love, and Jane Bowles, and Virginia Woolf, and a lot of chick writers. I like the women. Yeah.
Actually, I'd love to hear from that same question of an ideal reader, if you have one, and then what you're reading.
Janet.
Why do you keep doing that, Vanessa?
Because it's fun.
I always like to quote Laurie Anderson in any occasion I can. But she said that when asked a similar question, who do you write for, who do you perform for? And she said a slightly sadder version of myself. And I do have that sort of writing to cheer myself up, I guess. In terms of
who you're reading,
influences or things like that. Beckett and Kafka and Lydia Davis, she's sort of in that that line, that lineage. And then
what are you reading?
Oh, I was just saying my sort of what I'm reading. I've just returned to The Dead Father, which is the Bartolomé book. Bartolomé's a touchstone for me, and I love that book. And then I had something else to say, but things that are in this sort of satirical tradition, I would say. I've lost my train of thought. It'll come back to me.
Did you see
Vanessa?
That Beckett's letters just came out?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, and he talks about his love for Jane Austen.
Oh.
Yeah. That's great. Big clue. Yeah. Vanessa?
Let's see, which part first? The
ideal reader.
I hate that. I hate ideal readers. I don't actually think about readers because I think it is more this sort of object idea that, so I'm always trying to figure out how the words should go together or what should be done with the page. I don't know. I don't really think about readers at all. Is probably obvious in some ways. But in terms of influences, I read a lot of philosophy and I read a lot of poetry and a lot of art theory, actually, the three main things. I've done different things at different points. I once spent 6 months where all I would do is read and listen to Shakespeare's sonnets because I wanted to think about language in that way. So there's that. Some of it is just so obvious. Joyce. I'm trying to think of somebody slightly less obvious. But gas. I remember the first time I read The Tunnel, and that I thought, oh, this is interesting. And the Joyce that I think that most impressed me was Finnegan's Wake, when I said, oh, you can do this. That was something. And right now I'm reading Alain Badiou's Being and Event, and a lot of philosophy again, and I'm reading a book by Ambigen on Auschwitz. And I tried to read the Bolaño, but I thought it was really boring.
Savage Detectives?
No, the 2666. Yeah, I thought it was really,
read
really
Savage
boring.
Read Savage Detectives. It's
okay.
Incredible.
So.
It's really fun.
And I'm reading Gail Scott's My Paris, which is nice.
But another question. Three more. The hands are popping up.
I want to know what the purpose was of handing out these handouts while you were reading, because I was having a great deal of trouble concentrating on what you were reading.
So
while
it worked.
I was watching the people. So that was the purpose? So
that was part of the purpose.
That we could not concentrate on your reading?
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the purpose. There's a couple of things that, one of the things that, as Bridget pointed out, that I like to do in readings is, I really actually don't like readings. I find them sort of a horrible version of watching television, only less entertaining, actually. And so what I want to do with readings is a kind of institutional critique of the idea of the reading, and have it be a little bit of an event and a little bit difficult to up the interactive quotient. And part of it is, like in life, there's many things to distract you from listening to something that's complex. And so I can create that. I also invited people whose work that I like to hand out their work. So it was a little bit of trying to share the wealth, so to speak. And I also quite like the idea of ripping apart my book, because I made it, and so now I get to take it apart. And I guess that's it. And having objects. I think it's really nice to have an object from a reading. It's something, again, it sort of points out these are text objects. They are things. You can rip it up. You can throw it away. You can eat it. You can do whatever you want to with it. But there's a physicality to it as well. It's not just sound. But I also really do like the part where it's distracting and hopefully slightly annoying.
Sure, two more.
Two or three. Hi. Vanessa, you talked about your writing being sort of objects and materiality of language. And after reading Dies and what you read tonight, I was wondering if you can relate to it being sort of like, because after I read it, it was sort of, you were going into harmony and then disharmony, and it was very much like music and movement. And I was wondering if you could relate or agree that that's something that is applicable to how you write.
To music and movement?
Yeah, and sort of coming into harmony and then disharmony and then...
Yeah, and I think that there's a rhythm to it, and there's a... I think in terms of the content, I very much like to go with representation and abstraction and juxtapose those. And in terms of sound and movement, there is a part where, and I think I learned this from Beckett, where depending on where you put your commas, you can start having people breathe with you. And once I can have you breathe with me, it becomes a lot harder for you to fall off of what I'm saying. And that's when, I sort of liked the beginning question that Bridget said, but I didn't want to have it be an or, I wanted to have it be an and.
But you're thinking about a reader.
No, I'm not thinking about a reader. I'm just thinking about the way that perhaps the only... it's not a reader. I think it really is the thing of a. Like, I don't think that when I go into a gallery, I don't feel that I'm a viewer. I feel I'm a participant. You know, and so there is this thing of the seduction is the redemption, and the redemption is the seduction, and we're all sort of circling these objects together, and that's the very best thing that we can do. So I guess if that answers the movement question.
I think Veronica mentioned that when you write, you like to kind of closet yourself up and be solitary. this question to the panel is, assuming that's the case of all your writing, how does Los Angeles affect, like living in Los Angeles affect your writing and what you have written? And or would you say your writing would be similar, different, if you lived somewhere else?
I think you carry places inside of you, right? I mean, just because I'm in my room doesn't mean that I don't have all of these places inside of me. When I lived in New York, I wrote about Los Angeles a lot. And now that I'm here, I write about New York and Mexico City a lot. I don't really know how it's affected my writing except living here, except that there's a certain freedom here that I didn't feel in New York. In New York, there's like this, because it's the publishing world, there's this pressure from the outside to do things in a certain way. And no matter how hard how much I tried to not be affected by that, it's there. And here there's this freedom. The publishing world is really far away, and you can do things in a much more open way without feeling the pressure of this thing all around you and of everyone that you know doing things in a different way. But yeah, I think sitting in my room by myself, I have places inside of me. I hold them inside of me.
Yeah, I think L.A. is a great place to write. I also write a lot out in Joshua Tree in the desert, so there are even fewer people there. And I do think, in L.A., if you think about it, versus New York, where you'll just come into contact with 70 or 80 people over the course of the day, not people that you know, but that you're kind of bumping up against. In L.A., you're lucky if it's 10. And a lot of people kind of bemoan that about Los Angeles. And, you know, especially when I first moved here, I thought it was alienating. But it also means that you can just disappear for long periods of time, and that's okay, and no one asks where you are or sort of what you're doing. And I think people can also develop these kind of zanier visions out here, maybe. I think you see that in L.A. art as well versus New York art, where New York art is just kind of like they're climbing to the top, and when you see something really good, it's kind of the best of the best of a certain sort of genre or something. And then in L.A., you'll have someone like Jim Shaw, or you'll have these visions that couldn't exist anywhere else and are kind of prophetic. And I think it requires a lot of kind of space and air to come up with that.
Well, I wouldn't have written this book if I had lived somewhere else. Clearly, but part of it was also there was a little bit of contrariness because I kept hearing over and over about how you couldn't have one book that was all of Los Angeles, that it was just impossible because the city is so diffused. So that became a challenge to me. But I agree with everything everyone said. I think that it's true. There's no prize you're going to win by being the best innovative writer in Los Angeles, which opens it up quite a bit to doing whatever it is you're interested in doing. And perhaps this goes to, I think Los Angeles is fundamentally a solitary place, which is good for reflection and good for writing and good for narcissism, which is also good for writing. So,
on that note,
thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.